If you've always thought of Cleopatra as the ravishing queen with an insatiable appetite for men, there's a new book that says you've got it all wrong. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Cleopatra, Histories, Dreams, and Distortions.
First of all, Cleopatra wasn't really Egyptian. She was Greek. And the asp that bit her wasn't really an asp. It was a cobra. And it bit her on the arm, not the breast. And she was otherwise fully clothed, in her royal robes, not at all semi-naked as so many artists ever since 30 BC have painted her, because of their own sexual hang-ups. Nor was she especially pretty, not even by the standards of her pagan time. As you'd know from the nose stamped on the coins of a realm she managed very nicely, thank you, without any Roman help. She was a working queen, who spoke 9 languages, wrote some books, and cut a deal with the Nabataeans for oil rights in the Dead Sea. She was astonishingly celibate half her life. All those Romans kept stopping in Alexandria, not for a one-night stand, but because they needed her money and her naval fleet for their imperial war games. If Julius Caesar fathered 1 child on her, and Antony 3, from them she got in return a little this and a little that, like Lebanon and Syria, plus some prime real estate around Jericho, dates and balsam, from which she made a bundle by leasing it back to King Herod of Judea. Cleo and Antony were in the empire business themselves. Because Octavius won at Actium, he got to write the history books. He also got Virgil to write the Aeneid, glorifying his Augustan self. Lucy Hughes Hallett does for Cleopatra what Marina Warner did for Joan of Arc and the Virgin Mary. First, she demystifies. Then she looks into the reasons for the mystifications, the neuroses of succeeding male cultures that dreamed up whatever new Cleo they needed, lover, killer, bimbo, to mask how they really felt about women. Octavius is Apollo, and Antony is Dionysus, were small fry fantasies compared to the Cleos imagined by Boccaccio, Chaucer, and Dante, Shakespeare and Pascal, Pushkin, Swinburne, and Victor Hugo, Heine, Keats, and Cecil B. DeMille. Not to mention painters like Tiepolo, composers like Handel and Berlioz, postmodernists like Edward Said and Susan Sontag. In the Middle Ages, Cleo killed herself for the love of a man, like Dido and Thisbe. In the Renaissance, love itself was the enemy of reason, sexual passion a disease like madness, the expense of spirit and a waste of shame, damaging to the social order. The Reformation needed a bad girl. Romantics required a man-eating femme fatale, the morbid and mystical, the alien and other, a desert, a sphinx, and a serpent of desire, preferably recumbent, taking everything lying down, often underwater, in extreme torpor and fatal languor. A combination of pornography, window shopping, and tourism. George Bernard Shaw gave us Cleo as sex kitten, an enchanting pet, after which, the dumb broad. Out of their own ennui, decadents invented Elizabeth Taylor and camp. Whatever she looks like, this week or that century, Cleo is always symbolic of female nature versus male culture, what Hughes Hallett calls men's fear of sexuality as incarnated in women, as well as the face of Western racism projected on a lazy, duplicitous, nymphomaniacal Orient. Cleopatra is a wonderful feminist deconstruction with a very witty wink.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Cleopatra, Histories, Dreams, and Distortions.